That's what I used to do when I was presiding over the House of Representatives. You never bang a gavel. How's everyone? Good to see everybody. Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealth.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. I'm Ellen Tauscher, former State Department Special Envoy for Strategic Stability and Missile Defense, former Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security, and former member of Congress from the 10th District, which used to be in Walnut Creek. And I'm the moderator for today's program. General Michael Hayden is a highly decorated retired United States Air Force four-star general and former director of both the National Security Agency and the Central Intelligence Agency, the only person to have had both jobs. Mike is currently teaching at George Mason University, and drawing on his broad geographic and political knowledge, he now serves as a private security consultant and is the author of the new book, Playing to the Edge, American Intelligence in the Age of Terror. General Hayden was born on St. Patrick's Day in Pittsburgh and is an avid Steelers fan with several degrees in history from Duquesne University. I'm very pleased to welcome you to San Francisco and to the Commonwealth Club, Mike.
Thank you.
I've read your book, and it's very, very well done someone that hasn't written a lot of books before.
I've read a few, but never written. Yeah.
But it is your story, and I think you do a good job of representing your voice in this. And I know that you had a special series of reasons for doing this, to represent not only yourself, but also to the people that with whom you've worked for many decades. Your life effectively has been in military intelligence and national intelligence for all of these years. When you got to the NSA, and you got there before 9/11. Why don't we talk a little bit about the early parts of the book and what you found there? And what were some of the post-9/11 changes that people wouldn't necessarily expect? And talk a little bit about the NSA-created domestic phone call database.
Sure. So I'm a Clinton appointee to NSA. And when I got there in the spring of 99, the agency, which by any measure is a national treasure, it really is, was falling further and further behind a global telecommunications revolution. And what was happening was that a culture that had well served the agency for almost all of its life was now ill-suited for the environment in which the agency found itself. I mean, this is really almost Darwinian in describing it. You had an agency that for most of its life thrived with high walls and great secrecy because most of the things it needed to do its job, it had to invent itself. They weren't available in the larger society. So you can trace the roots of American computing back to Fort Meade. You can still trace the roots of American mathematics back to Fort Meade. It's still the greatest concentration of math PhDs on the planet. But as we went through this global telecommunications revolution, and we went from something 1.0 to 2.0 or G1 or G2 or G3, the agency was falling further and further behind what was going on in the outside world. And the walls that were very well suited for keeping the secrets in were actually almost pathological for keeping what was happening out here from entering inside the agency. So we knew we had to undergo some fundamental changes. And so those are the first several chapters of the book. I had my epiphany in January of 2000. I've been director for about 8 or 9 months and pretty much following the Hippocratic Oath there, first do no harm. And our IT system went belly up. I mean, it just ended. It just stopped. We're still collecting out there on the outer edges of the enterprise, but once we got it into our buffers, we couldn't move it. And so for 3.5 days, the United States of America wasn't listening to anyone. All right, it had no ability to collect foreign intelligence through the intercept of targeted communications. So at that point, I just decided, okay, we got to go. Mm-hmm. All right? There is no course of action I could set out on that would be more dangerous to the agency's future than standing still. And so at that point, to use an airman's phrase, I just pushed the yoke and the throttle forward, and we were going to go. 9/11 hit, and to round out the change in NSA's yes. story, we called it transformation. When 9/11 hit, you had this trajectory we were on, all right, which by the way included metadata well before any terrorist attack. It included the reality that if we were going to do our job in the 21st century the way we did it in the 20th, we had to be on networks with your communications, because that's where the targeted communications were. And so we had this transformational urge going on, meeting about 2x funding coming into us after 9/11. I mean, after 9/11, I mean, we just decided as a nation we got to spend more money on this. And so you had that thing coming to the merge. So anyway, there's a lot more to be said, but that's kind of the outline of what was happening. And then we get to 9/11, and
right,
yeah.
So we were both in Washington on 9/11. I was there. Actually, the Congress wasn't in session that day.
Yeah.
We were going in that evening. It was a Tuesday. Beautiful
morning.
Day.
Yep.
Beautiful
gorgeous.
Day.
Not a cloud anywhere on the East Coast.
Right. And you were in a meeting.
Yeah.
And you get called out, and yeah. you begin to understand that it was not a small plane. It was not an accident. The second plane hits. Then eventually you and George Tenet, yeah. then the director of the CIA, are talking. What exactly
sure.
was
and
that day?
How do we get to yes. what it was we did, and it's become yes. controversial? Yeah, so I'm in the office. I'm like you. My executive assistant, Cindy, comes in, plane at the World Trade Center. I'm thinking it's a sport plane. She comes in, sir, plane at the other tower. I said, all right, get Kemp up here right away. Kemp ran our security. Kemp is walking into my office in one door as Cindy, my executive assistant, is coming in the other with reports of explosions on the Mall. That was a garble of the plane hitting the Pentagon. So poor Kemp doesn't even open his mouth. I say, Kemp, all non-essential personnel out of here now. So he just does an about face. You got about 15,000 people come to work at Fort Meade, roughly estimating about 10,000 left. 5,000 were essential and continued work. There are lots of stories on that day. They're in the book. But on this narrow stream, by late afternoon, I had already begun to change things well within my authority, already begun to change things NSA was doing. I already told you that in the 21st century communications, targeted communications and innocent communications are on the same network. I didn't mention it, but an awful lot of communications of legitimate interest to NSA entered the United States. Right? We have a process that keeps your privacy protected. It's called minimization, which means that, you know, if we're listening to a legitimate target over here, and that target talks to you or talks about you, we still have to protect your identity. We minimize the identity. So you become U.S. person number one in the reporting. Unless your identity is the intelligence.
Exactly.
All right? I mean, I've got a bad guy in Pakistan talking to someone in the Bronx and says, brother, the attack, you need to act by tomorrow at noon. Your identity is the intelligence. I mean, we are not saying, well, he talked to U.S. person number one.
It's the actionable intelligence.
Yeah, it's the actionable stuff. And that was real simple. But in the real world, there are always gradations as to, you know, when does the U.S. identity become essential to the intelligence? NSA, prior to 9/11, was very, very conservative. I just changed the rheostat. I want you to lean a little bit more forward. I don't want you to make our customer go through the two-day bureaucratic process to say, well, could you tell me who U.S. person number one was? So, you know, it wasn't profligate. It wasn't lawless. It was just on that balancing, we're going to go a little bit forward. So I called George Tenet, the DCI. I called the committees. Right. Told both committees, I'm changing the rheostat here. We're leaning a little forward.
So these are the House and Senate.
Yeah,
the House Intelligence Committees.
You. Yeah. So George Tenet then goes in and tells the president. Actually, what he said was, Hayden, not an NSA? Yeah, he's going to jail. And the vice president muttered something like, well, tell him we're going to bail him out, all right? And in essence, George was simply, in a flippant way, saying he's not doing it the way he was doing it before. And like I said, we told the committees, everyone knew. And the president then says, well, is he doing everything he can do? And George said, I'll ask. So George calls me, and he comes back to his office. He calls me up. And this is all happening in real time. I mean, we still got smoke coming out of the Pentagon, smoke coming out of Western Pennsylvania, smoke coming out of the towers. George calls me and says, the president wants to know if there's anything more you could do. I said, George, I cannot do anything more within my current authorities. And Tenet actually says, that's not exactly the question I asked you, Mike. Can you do more? And I said, well, we'll get back to you. So I huddled up with my lawyers and my ops folks. We came up with what became the terrorist surveillance program. Became part of it was the metadata collection program. We began dialogue with the White House. We began dialogue with the Department of Justice. I began dialogue with my own orders, or my own lawyers. And about the 2nd of October, the president signed an authorization that allowed us to do things that I would have considered to be an unreasonable imposition on your privacy on September 10th, but which neither I nor the president nor the Department of Justice considered an unreasonable imposition on your privacy after the attacks. And by the way, the Constitution doesn't protect us against search and seizure. It protects us against unreasonable search and seizure. And the metadata, okay, which is what we're talking about here, the phone bill, the fact of call, in a Supreme Court decision in 1979 was determined not to be constitutionally protected. So there's a lot more to be said, but anyway, that's what got us to that point.
So after the recent Paris attacks, I think many of you will recall that President Hollande went to Élysée Palace and asked the French Parliament to give him more powers, very similar to what President Bush did. The question is, how do you know when to come back to a new normal? And how do you dial back, after the threat has been mitigated, God willing, no more attacks, no more sense of urgency? When do you dial that back? Because I think that's the natural sense that people want to recover. They want to have a sense that, these powers that are necessary during a time of extreme threat recede.
Yeah. No, that's a great question. So, and you bring up a wonderful example. So after the Paris attacks, President Hollande goes to the French Parliament. Actually, Cameron goes to the British Parliament. Actually, Angela Merkel goes to the Bundestag. And they all ask for things from their parliamentary bodies. I was on Morning Joe after the attack, and Scarborough says, so it sounds like these countries are going to kind of do their own Patriot Act, Hayden. And I just started laughing. I said, you got to be kidding, Joe. I mean, the things they are asking would never breathe in the American political system.
Right. They could nobody get away with it.
No one. I mean, so here you have these other Western democracies now feeling the pain like we did 15 years ago, going to their parliaments for things that would never survive in the American political, never see the light of day. Yeah. So your question, though, is so how do you throttle back? And that is a great question. My wife Janine is here with me, and she was with me at University of Michigan on a September 11th anniversary 4 years ago now. And I held up my right hand saying, these are all the things we're doing, all right? And I'm feeling comfortable with it, and I go through this long, elaborate, the things up here, the big attacks, that's not going to happen. The drive-by shootings, the Little Rocks, the Fort Hoods, they may happen. And then I asked the University of Michigan audience, so what do you want me to do with my right arm? How much more of your privacy, your convenience, and your commerce do you want me to squeeze in order to now defend you against these things up here unlikely to happen. But how much do you want me to do to stop these down here, the lower order attacks, right? And I actually said, oh, by the way, that is not an espionage question. That is not an intelligence officer question. That is a political guidance question. The processes of the republic have to decide that, all right? As you're asking me as a citizen, my arm's about where I want it to be. You know, I don't want to be taken off anymore out at SFO when I'm leaving. I think we're about at the limit of where we need to be. And then, to get to your question, I said, let me ask you the really tough question. When do you want my arm to start going like this? When do you want me to start throttling back? And I made the point then, whoever does that is going to require incredible political courage. Because of that, chairman, president, whatever, says, we're okay now, we can stop doing this, and something bad happens, that is political self-immolation. So it's a great question. How do you know when to pull back? Because all the political processes will push you in the direction of not pulling back.
Mm-hmm. So you grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Irish Catholic family,
yeah.
Steelers fan.
Yeah. Guilty on all counts.
Yeah. So going to church, going to Catholic school, what were the disciplines that you learned that prepared you for a military career and
the intelligence world?
Yeah,
I was in America's Air Force before I had ever entered a classroom that did not have a crucifix in it. Okay. So I'm talking about that Catholic liberal arts tradition from first grade through graduate school. Right? One thing it really gave me was an appreciation of Western civilization and Western history. And that is a real value for someone in the intelligence profession. We Americans get a well-earned and complimentary reputation for being very pragmatic, very can-do. I've been in these meetings. You know, the Americans go into the meetings, they got their jackets off already, they're rolling up their sleeves, and they're saying, all right, what's the problem here? When in reality, Joe Nye wrote this in a book 30 years ago, he said, that's not the right question. The right question is, what's the story? Mm-hmm. All right, and so that served me very, very well in the ethical dimension. I think I have, and you know, honest men can differ whether how I've applied it, and that's probably going to show up in a question or two before we're done. But I do have a deep understanding, I think, of Western value system. I mean, I've done the whole Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Thomas Aquinas, Thomistic theology, Summa Theologica, just war theory. I got all that. And so I actually spent some time in the book. I talk about it in cyber weapons.
That's right.
But it also applied to targeted killings. You know, the principles coming. This is Thomistic. This is coming out of Aquinas. Okay. Necessity, distinction, proportionality. Before you actually exercise violence, before your military exercises violence on your behalf, it gets rung through this filter that Western society, Western civilization has created for us.
So both Nancy Pelosi, who represents San Francisco before she became the Speaker and the Minority Leader, was the Democratic Minority Head of the House Intelligence Committee. My good friend, our senior senator, Dianne Feinstein, has been the chairman and the number two as the ranking member on intelligence. You know, in the last couple of years, the Senate committee put out their CIA report. And, you know, it has been reviewed by lots of people. Generally, people believe that the report itself is fact-based. But you particularly feel as if there was a partisan piece to this.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people know now that when originally the committee was going to do the report because they wanted the American people to know what happened, the congressional committees are really there not only to manage the money but to provide oversight. We're meant to lean in and do what the American people would want us to do, to ask the questions. And when the committee originally did it, it was going to be a bipartisan effort. as they started to look at what exactly happened, the Republicans decided that they didn't like what was going on, and they decided to back away. And so at the time, Senator Feinstein was in the majority, and she decided to continue. The professional staff is nonpartisan, and so, but it took them quite a few years.
4 years?
Quite a few dinners that I had with her to get through the process. You know, it is partisan. The Congress is partisan. Why don't you talk a little bit about what your concerns have been? And I think some of this too is about the morale of the people.
At the agency.
In generally, in the intelligence community. Why don't you talk about that too?
Sure. Look, this is very complicated. And frankly, there are no bad people here, all right? These people acting in accordance with their principles. But you know, if you read that chapter in the book, you got to conclude I strongly disagree with the conclusions of the Senate Intel Committee Democrat report. And by the way, there's a Republican report too. They put one out as well, and they're very different. So what's to be said? CIA held about 120 people in the life of the program, and even that's contentious, all right? I mean, how do you book them? I mean, it's a battlefield capture that gets transferred to a third party very quickly. Is that in the stack, not in the stack? And so it was even difficult to get precisely how many we held. I use the figure of about 100, all right? Of the about 100, about a third had what we called enhanced interrogation techniques used against them. And of that total, 3 in the life of the program were waterboarded. All right, and the last waterboarding was in March of 2003. So this is way on. So I become director in the summer of 2006, May of 2006. And I got to make some decisions about the program. I mean, talk about an elephant in the room. All right? The program has kind of gone out of being only known to a small group in Washington. Dana Priest wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning series in the Washington Post that laid it out. And so I spent the summer of 06 kind of getting a PhD on renditions, detentions, and interrogations, which is what we call the program, RDI. And I was pretty much a blank slate. I mean, I could have veered off and said, we're not going to do this anymore. That was then. This is now. I'd have been a white knight to certain folks in the in Washington. Here's what we decided. And again, I took all summer. And so I went into Steve Hadley. And I actually found my notes from the Hadley meeting. So that formed the outline.
National Security Advisor.
I'm sorry. Yeah, Steve was the National Security Advisor. So that forms the outline of what you might read in the book. I went into Steve with 5 or 6 big points. Says, number one, Steve, we are not the nation's jailers. Right? And so we should not be keeping people forever. I get it. We got them here because we want to get intelligence out of them. And the intelligence value is never getting to zero. But frankly, Steve, it's close enough to zero now that some other things are kicking in. We don't need to keep these people any longer. So the first thing I said was we have to empty the black sites. And we did. Over Labor Day weekend, we shipped the last 14 we had to Guantanamo. All right. So empty the sites. It's different from closing them. All right. Empty them. Obviously, I wanted to keep some options open. I said, Steve, we got too few people on the Hill who know what we're doing. We have got to go to the entire committees. Prior to that time, it was the Gang of Eight, and which is perfectly legal. I mean, that statute actually allows the president to decide only to inform 8 rather than actually 22 in the House and 15 in the Senate.
So these are the ranking member and the chairman. So it's a Democrat, Republican on either side, and they're usually in the leadership of the committees, both on the House and Senate side.
Yeah. So now we need to go full money to the full committees, and then we need the president to go forward and tell the American people what we've done. And then I said, I don't want to end the program. I want to restrict it. But I actually felt in conscience, although there was some temptation, let's just lock this thing over, and that we needed to keep this option available. So we kept the sites open. I said to Steve, the National Security Advisor, we're going to have a time limit on how long we keep people. It's going to be about 60 days. We can extend that, but you got to consciously extend it, whereas before you got them, you had them, and
And this is based because you believe that the intelligence they have degrades
over
time.
It ages off. I mean, after a while, it's not that current anymore.
Right.
So keep them open 60 days. No one comes in the front door with an already agreed plan as to what the exit door was. You know, where they were going to go, Guantanamo to a third country, both of which are very contentious, all right? And then with regard to the techniques, I inherited 13. We had skinned it down to 7. And then by the time we were done in the summer, we skinned it down to 6. And that was the program going forward. I actually put 2 people in the black sites, Abdul Hadi al-Raqi and Muhammad Rahim. And we used enhanced techniques on one, Muhammad Rahim. They were not necessary on the other. He talked quite willingly. So that's kind of the history. Sorry, that's all the wind-up. Now we come to the report. I wish they would have talked to somebody. This is a purely document-based study. There were no interviews. No human beings currently or formerly employed by the Central Intelligence Agency were interviewed by staff or committee.
And they say that they did that because everybody would have lawyered up. If anybody that watches Law and Order knows that you lawyer up right away. And that it would have been difficult.
The crossover point was that simultaneously, all right, the Attorney General decided to reopen cases against CIA officers that had been closed several years earlier by career prosecutors in the Eastern District of Virginia. All right, so I'm kind of complaining up here now, all right? And he decided to reopen the cases without reading the original declinations. All right, so now you've got court cases running. Well, yeah, there's nobody going to go talk to Congress about this while they might have to end up in front of a grand jury. All right, so that did freeze.
Chill
is a great word. Now that ended about 2 years before the report came out.
That's right.
So the argument we make is, okay, that's done. If you wanted to talk to human beings, now you can talk to human beings. All right, and that wasn't done. Senator Feinstein believes very strongly in this. She's incredibly sincere and, as you know, very hardworking. All right. I make the point in the book that we got called in by CIA. We didn't know this was going on. Okay. I mean, I get a phone call from Tenet about, 2013 maybe. Yeah. George says, are you aware of the study? You go, what study? And it's beginning to leak out that this thing is going on. So we get called in the Thursday after Election Day, 2012. And Dave Petraeus, who's his current director, is calling all the formers in to kind of say, well, I got to tell you about this here study. And we're kind of like, what study? Now, Petraeus doesn't make the meeting. Dave, you remember your history?
Remember the timetable?
Okay. You with me here? Okay. So Mike Morrell, his deputy, takes the meeting. So Porter flies up. Porter Goss flies up from Florida. George comes down from New York. I come from around the corner. I live in McLean, all right, and come over. And Michael Morrell is explaining to us what's going on. And I said, for God's sake, Michael, why is this happening? We're never going to do this again. The president has taken this off the board. We all agreed that, new guidance, new president, we're not going to go do it. Why are we doing this? And Michael Morrell, who was the now acting director, looks at us and says, well, we talked to the staff director, and he said, we're doing this study to make sure this never happens again. And all the intelligence professionals in the room kind of swallowed hard and said, man, that looks like a conclusion in search of evidence. So you asked.
I did.
That's my view.
So let's talk about Guantanamo. The president has put forward a plan.
Can we go back to Catholic grade school and talk about some of those things?
No, later on. While I was in the Congress, and the Republicans were in the majority in the House and part of the time in the Senate, they passed a series of laws basically saying that they couldn't really write a law that said you couldn't close Guantanamo. So instead, they wrote laws that said that you couldn't move the prisoners out and put them on CONUS. So you can't take them from Cuba and bring them to the continental United States. And I was on the Armed Services Committee at the time. We were looking at the Supermax prison in Florence,
Colorado.
You know, there are four or five Supermax prisons that are where the worst of the worst of the worst are going to be there for the rest of their very natural lives. And, you know, these are places where you could segregate and actually put people and not go to a lot of expense. But a lot of two or three laws were passed where that was cut off and no president could actually bring them back. Those laws are still there. So the president is talking about, and then an effort was made because there were a number of people. I went to Guantanamo on one of the first trips that the Congress went to go see it, and it's really hot and humid there. And the prison had grown dramatically. And at the time, we may have had about 200 people. When Secretary Clinton came in, she and President Obama embarked on an effort to repatriate as many people that could be repatriated, if their countries would take them back, if they had been rolled up on, if they had gone out for a pack of cigarettes and never went home again. They had been on a street corner, they got rolled up with a couple of other bad guys, they were just the wrong guy in the wrong place. There were ways for us, and we could never adjudicate them. Some of those people were taken back. There were Chinese Uyghurs that were sent to Bermuda. There were Yemenis that were sent to Central Europe. The population was coming down. So the president is now saying, you know, there are some people that can never be released, but even for the ones that cannot be released, it is unlikely they can be adjudicated.
Right.
And so what do you think about the president's plan?
Sure.
What do you think the success of it might be? What do you actually think the outcome should be?
So, to begin, it's something very important. Whatever happens should not also create a constitutional crisis. Mm-hmm. The two political branches should get together and figure out something.
Good luck with that.
Well, yeah, but imagine, you know, if the president decides, my commander-in-chief authority gives me the ability to override the statute, bipartisan statute, by the way, that Congress has passed saying you can't bring them here, right? So, Number one, let us not do this with a constitutional crisis. Number two, for better or for worse, we Americans know how to imprison people. All right? There's no problem imprisoning these people in the United States. No security problem. There are some latent legal issues that might make their legal status more complicated if they are on American soil as opposed to being on Cuban soil. All right? And that's not trivial. All right? That needs to be firmly and forwardly, openly addressed as to what might happen with regard to their legal status. I should add that the Bush administration pushed more people out of Guantanamo than the Obama administration.
Mm-hmm.
All right? This is an arc of continuity between the two administrations. All right? Now to personal opinion. All right? Here's the issue as I see it, and it's not geography. All right? Actually, Guantanamo is a model prison now. All right. The issue with Guantanamo is the brand, not the reality. All right. But I'm indifferent to the geography. Here's the issue to me. We are a nation at war. We've had two presidents, quite different in their personalities and approaches, say we are a nation at war with Al-Qaeda affiliates and ISIS. Congress has passed as close to a declaration of war as Congress will ever pass again in the authorization for the use of military force. We are at war with these people. That's why we can kill them legally on battlefields that are not internationally accepted theaters of conflict. That's why we can do targeted killings. Both presidents have embraced that. Another activity incident to the conduct of war against an opposing armed enemy force is to capture the enemy. Right? And to capture the enemy, not because you're going to try them, but to capture the enemy under the laws of armed conflict. And here's one way the Guantanamo debate really gets muddled. Because some people in their passion say, you have got to try them, otherwise their confinement is lawless. No, it is not. There are a variety of legal frameworks that we can use. One of them is American criminal justice. The other is under the laws of armed conflict. Again, if you don't believe you're in a conflict, you don't get to kill them. All right? And the president actually implicitly admits this because he says we've got forever prisoners.
Right.
All right? We've got people we're never going to try and we're never going to release. All right? I think as part of a grand package, all right? I think it was part of a grand package that the president would actually embrace a forward-looking view that, regardless of where we keep them, it might make it more attractive to keep them here if it's part of a package, it's part of a forward-looking view that he will actually capture people under the laws of armed conflict. For the last 7 years, we have only captured people that we believe we can try. Okay? I actually think we should allow ourselves to capture them as prisoners of war. And by the way, there's a very perverse secondary effect. All right? If you should have three options, kill, try, or capture. And you take capture as prisoners of war off the table, guess what you're left with? You're left with either I've got to have enough evidence to try him in an Article III court, or I have to kill him. Okay, so it's more complicated than just the geography. And I do think if we just get to this level and say, okay, what's the plan? All right, what is it we are allowed to do? And then, frankly, I think a lot of people like me would be indifferent to geography. Lindsey Graham is indifferent to the geography.
Right.
I mean, he actually was trying to be very creative with ways to close Guantanamo. Now, one final point. Guantanamo does not affect the recruitment of Al-Qaeda and ISIS. It does not. All right, imagine yourself, okay, we're a video camera now. We're in the recruiting line at Raqqa. All right, we got 220-somethings there about ready to sign up for ISIS, and one of them gets a tweet. Holy smoke, they're closing Guantanamo. Okay, brother, it's time to go home. I mean, that is not going to happen. Okay? It is an irritant with our European friends.
It is.
All right? They don't have our... But by the way, you know, the president deciding to keep forever prisoners in the United States
right.
is still going to be an irritant with our European friends.
Right. But at least the rallying cry of Guantanamo.
Yeah. So, like everything I try to express in the book, these are not simple, and to reduce them to the level of bumper stickers does violence to our reasoning as a free people.
Well, now's the time for our audience question period, and we've got a lot of questions, so let's begin. This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking to General Michael Hayden, former director of both the National Security Agency and the Central Intelligence Agency, and the author of the new book, Playing to the Edge, American Intelligence in the Age of Terror. I'm Ellen Tauscher, your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on your YouTube channel. Let's talk about Edward Snowden. You do talk about it.
I do. I got a whole chapter on Snowden.
Well, yes, you do. Why don't you talk...
Or Voldemort. I can't remember which one it was.
Why don't you tell us about the net effect of
Sure.
Mr. Snowden?
So the last chapter on the book is kind of, I call it post-government life or something, right. But it's really, it begins with my getting an email in a hotel down in San Diego from Mark Hosenball, who's now a Reuters reporter, saying, what is this? And it was the Guardian story on the metadata program, all right? I chose not to respond to the email, all right, because I knew what it was. It was what I started back in October 2nd, 2001, mm-hmm. all right? And thus began the Snowden revelations. I'm very clear in the book. I think the young man has done tremendous harm to your safety, all right? He really has. Now, I do admit in the book that he has accelerated a necessary conversation. All right. I also say he distorted that necessary conversation, but I give him credit for accelerating it. But then I go on to say the other 98% of the stuff he revealed has nothing to do with your privacy. This is the single greatest hemorrhaging of legitimate American secrets in the history of the Republic. I mean, what is your privacy quotient in his giving documents to reporters that made public the fact that the National Security Agency could intercept the unclassified emails of the Syrian armed forces? Okay. What of your Fourth Amendment rights were being threatened, all right, so that he had to tell the world, through reporters, that NSA and GCHQ had the ability to intercept Dmitry Medvedev's satellite phone during a G20 meeting in the United Kingdom? I can go on and on with concrete examples like that. So that's probably a good enough start.
Well, but we have another privacy security paradigm, and it's with this Apple situation.
Yeah.
You've been very busy over the last couple of weeks. I've seen you on four or five different television shows, radio shows, Michael Krasny Today here in the Bay Area. I was a little surprised about your position on the Apple situation. This is about the San Bernardino phone owned by... The nice thing about being in San Francisco is everybody here reads three or four newspapers. We don't have to tell them very much about this. But why don't you talk about what your position is?
I would suggest I'm trending Apple on the dispute. And I'm trending Apple on security grounds. All right, I could sit here and talk about, you know, I'm not so sure the government has the right to compel a private company, so on and so forth. That's a pretty good argument, but it's not my argument. I got no expertise in that. I could actually do this on that security privacy thing and about privacy, but, you know, I'm not a privacy expert. I'm a security guy. And I actually think through the lens of security, America is more secure with unbreakable end-to-end encryption, and that we should not degrade that encryption, even for very good legitimate reasons over here. Jim Clapper is the current director of National Intelligence. The last 3 years, certainly the last two, I think it's the last three, Jim in what's called the Worldwide Threat Briefing, which is going on right now, all right? Jim has said the most serious threat to the United States is the cyber threat. And so why would you degrade our capacity to defend against the cyber threat, even for very good reasons over here for the criminal threat or even the terrorist threat? I was the director of NSA, all right? When somebody told me that someone else has created, the euphemism is, extraordinary access, all right, which means there's a door or a window or something that gets you through the wall of encryption. As director of NSA, when somebody told me that was the reality with regard to a target, my first reaction was, thank you, Jesus, okay? Because now my odds of getting into that and breaking that encryption were significantly increased, right? Now, you got the San Bernardino thing, and it's not quite creating extraordinary access into the encryption, right? These are actually severable events or severable strands. Mm-hmm. And Director Comey, whom I understand why he's making his arguments, Director Comey says, what you got here is one off, one phone, one time, one really bad thing. But you got other phones in the wings waiting to be unlocked. You got U.S. Attorney Vance over in Manhattan saying, I got a room full of these things. He actually has 175. And so I don't think this can be confined to the one off. I fear, although B is different than A, I fear that B is going to lead to A. Okay? And so I trend in the direction of the Apple argument. And again, I'm doing it through a security lens. Okay? Now, it's funny you should mention it, Mr. Snowden trends Apple too. Mm-hmm. But he does it through a privacy lens. All right, so we've actually ended up in the same place, even though I don't walk back any of the comments I made earlier.
So the entire cyber threat, the reliance on technology, all of the issues that are now creating vulnerabilities, both for our economic security and our national security, only recently, I think, have most people found out that there's a thing called the dark net. What is the our capability of piercing the dark net? Isn't that where all the bad guys are going and where they're living? They're encrypting everything. How do we actually get ahead of this?
Yeah, it's very hard. Remember, first question, NSA falling behind, how are you going to do this and so on? I mean, that's exactly what we're talking about. I inherited an agency that was pretty good intercepting high-frequency voice and manual Morse code transmissions, okay? And now we're moving into a world, all right, that was technologically challenging, but also legally and ethically challenging. Mm-hmm. I mean, I tell the story in the book. I can't find a civil libertarian who gave a damn about our intercepting Soviet strategic rocket forces communications from Moscow going out to the ICBM fields in the Soviet Far East, you know, looking for what we call words of interest, like launch, all right? But the 21st century equivalent of those are your emails and mine coexisting with terrorist, proliferator, and trafficker communications in the same World Wide Web. So you've got this jumble, and we're tech. To answer your question, it's hard technologically, but that's not the long pole in the tent. The long pole in the tent is what legitimacy will you give your security services to go where they have to go if they're going to do for you in the 21st century what they did for you in the 20th. And that's really where the issue comes in.
So, Mike, how do we get the balance right between the necessary oversight, congressional and executive branch, and the agencies who are pressed during a time of threat and war to be right for an impossible number of times when the threat is persistent and when it's pervasive? How do you get that balance right? Because I do hear in the book, I was on the other side of the fence. I was in the Congress the entire time you were in those two jobs. I do hear kind of a frustration about the overseers and the Congress and stuff. I can understand it. But how do we get that balance right?
So to be fair, no member of the Oversight Committee gets a bridge built or a road paved in the home district for being on the Intelligence Committee.
That's right.
All right, so you really, no, I'm serious. You really got a nod to these folks. This is a labor of dedication and a labor of love. But it's really hard work, all right? Now, God, there's so many things to be said. Number one, we're talking about more oversight, better oversight, more transparency to the overseers, more transparency to the general public as a necessary cost of doing business in our current political culture. I get that. And I make the case in the book that we have to accommodate to that. That's just
right.
The way it is. You all also, however, need to know what our line of departure is. That's the military term for where the march begins, right? You are citizens of a nation with the most transparent intelligence community on the planet. Okay? Europeans know more about your intelligence services than they know about theirs. And I'm talking about European parliamentarians.
That's right.
All right? I mean, I can tell you instances where congressmen would come and say, I want to go to facility X over here that's a joint American host facility. And you go, I'm sorry, you can't go. Well, what do you mean I can't go? I just went to the identical facility over here in New Mexico. All right? Yeah, I know. You can go to the one in New Mexico, but you can't go to the one here because no parliamentarian from the host government has ever been allowed to go. All right? So our line of departure here is it's actually, globally speaking, a very high level of transparency, oversight, and parliamentary invasiveness into what in the rest of the world is almost an exclusive executive prerogative, right? Now, this is not my complaint about that. This is descriptive, all right? It's not meant to change anything. And now, in our wisdom, we've decided, yeah, but it's still not good enough for us, and we've got to ratchet it up. So there are lots of ways. One, you and I talked about, one is term limits for members of the Intel committees. They have term limits. This is really obscure stuff. I mean, this is really hard. And so somebody's on the committee for 6 years, and okay, you got to go now. Wait a minute. I just know what the letters mean, you know? So I think to end term limits would be one. These are the worst committees to put strongly political people.
That's right.
All right? This is not where you want to put your true believers. All right? This is where you want to put your pragmatists, and that applies to both parties. Right, and for a long time, that was kind of the way it was thought to be. Mm-hmm. So you want to make these as apolitical as possible. Give them longer term limits. And I'll give you one other reality. All right, to the degree that the executive is not forward leaning enough, that reticence does not come from the permanent government folks. Mm-hmm. That reticence comes from the transient government folks in the executive branch. Okay? There is no upside for the director of CIA not keeping Congress fully and currently informed, which is what the statute requires. Because you and your agency are going to be around when those other guys are gone. So that I don't know if I mentioned this in the book. If I didn't, I should have. I was President Obama's CIA chief for 3 weeks. Okay, and I understand there's a certain reputation for the Bush administration, certain image for the Obama administration. We had a successful operational activity that y'all would have been proud of that happened in those 3 weeks where I was DCIA for President Obama. And I mentioned it on the margins of an NSC meeting. Actually, it was a principal's meeting, so the president wasn't there. It was everyone else but the president. And I said, so on and so forth, and we did that, and everyone goes, yeah, good on you, that was great. And I said, oh, by the way, I'm going to have to tell the Hill. This is the new administration. And the response I get was, I'm not so sure you have to. Okay. So this is an Article 1, Article 2 built-in tension. Blame James Madison, blame George Mason, all right? It comes with the turf. And so I guess what I'm saying is, it's the permanent government guys who are usually pushing their executive branch policy masters to tell the Congress more. This is not, I'm going to regret saying this, but it's kind of your get out of jail free card. Okay? I mean, I got a better way of putting it. I'm a 39-year airman. If you want these people to be with you at the crash, you got to put them on the manifest.
Yes. So we're in a political season, and it's gotten silly pretty quickly. There is a presidential candidate that actually says that bringing back torture is not such a bad idea. Yeah. Obviously, John McCain's not convinced of that. Yeah. I don't think you're convinced of that. How do we take the heat out of these conversations? And maybe not with this person we ever can, but how do we get ourselves to a place where we've all decided to decide what we're going to do going forward?
So we're talking about a particular candidate who actually said something like this, and also we need to hold terrorist families at risk too.
Right.
Okay. Let me talk about both. The first one you mentioned, Ellen, is a little more complicated, all right? Mm-hmm. Because frankly, I don't believe it was torture. Okay. Torture is a narrowly defined legal term. All right, there were enhanced interrogation techniques. I get it. Honest people can differ. All right, but I have actually said if a President Trump wants to return to waterboarding, he has to bring his own bucket.
Right.
Okay. And not because I'm condemning what went on before. In fact, I don't. All right. What I'm saying is the CIA is not going to do it. Back to the sense of betrayal.
Right.
Back to the We did this in good faith, and now all this is happening. So there really is an issue there that CIA officers are not going to go do this, all right? And then candidate Trump says, and a lot more, and we're going to do it because they deserve it. And I this is where I really add in, says, we never did anything because they deserved it. We are not your criminal justice arm, all right?
Or the revenge arm.
And we're not your vengeance arm either. We're your intelligence people. We did this not backward-looking, but forward-looking. We did this not because they deserved it for past activity, but because we believe they had information for future activity. And I get it. We can argue about the appropriateness of that, but it was never this. It was that. And then I actually said on Bill Maher when they brought up we're going to hold terrorist families at risk, I just simply said the armed forces of the United States are not going to carry out that order. And take that to the bank. Okay, your armed forces will not do that. These are honorable men and women. They have professional ethics, and that is a violation of the laws of armed conflict. They will not do it. Now, Bill Maher says, so we're talking about a coup. And I said, no, I'm just saying that an unlawful order is not an order. And in fact, you are required not to obey a lawful order. It's not that you are... Okay, never mind.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So the CIA today, in the world of cyber and the world of ISIS and other threats, destabilized countries all through the Middle East, Russia, lots of different issues. Do we have the tools we need?
Yeah.
Do we have the money we need? Do we have the posture that we need? And does the agency feel as if it has the trust of the American people?
Boy, a lot in there. Let me unpack them quickly. I was my last year or two at CIA, I was a little embarrassed to go to the folks downtown for more money. I had $2 when I was director for every $1 George Tenet had on September 10th. You all have given us a lot of money. You have also given us a lot of good people. I was authorized by President Bush to increase the number of analysts and case officers by 50%. The last year I was director, I had 160,000 applicants to choose from. Okay, so we are well blessed with resources. So that's one reality. So I wouldn't complain about that. The trust thing is kind of the whoop and war for the book. You know, how in a modern era, in a world that demands more transparency, how do you do secret espionage in a way that y'all are comfortable, that you're comfortable that you know enough, and you're comfortable with what is being done on your behalf? And that's really hard.
And but, Mike, talk about why you wrote the book, because I know you. I've known you for many years. You weren't going to write a book about yourself.
No.
You wrote a book because you could, as the only person to head the NSA and the CIA, you could speak for the tens of thousands of people that probably could write a book but maybe not get it published and be on Bill Maher the other night.
So I write the book, I get the manuscript pretty well mature, and then I decide I need to write a foreword. You know, why'd you write this book? Actually, I think I call it, why'd I write this book? And I talk about an incident where I was at Alice Springs in Australia, right way in the middle of the outback. And I'm coming out of a facility. By the way, I was really shocked they let me say Alice Springs. I think I'm the first one ever to say, maybe there's something interesting at Alice Springs.
And talk about the Five Eyes.
Oh, yeah. And it was a Five Eyes get-together. So it was all the Anglo-Saxon spies getting together.
They're called the Five Eyes.
Yeah. And they all go back to Bletchley Park. You saw the movie? Right? You know, Imitation Game, Enigma. Okay. Yeah. There's
Bletchley Park.
Yeah. There's a heritage there that pulls these five English-speaking democracies into a very tight-knit club. All right? So we're there having a huddle. We're walking out of the facility at Alice Springs. I mean, it is literally in the middle of nowhere. I mentioned in the book, you come down the road, you hit a street, you hit a sign, Alice Springs, 12 kilometers. Ayers Rock, 750. That's all there is. And I turned to my Australian counterpart and said, wouldn't you like to take your citizens back in there on that floor and show them what your kids are doing? And he goes, yeah. That's kind of what I wanted to do. I wanted to take my countrymen, walk them up to the cipher lock, punch in the code, open the vault door, and say, come on in with me. To the degree allowed by law, I want you to meet some people, and I want you to see what they do on your behalf. And thank you for asking this. And if I can do that well, I am quite comfortable with whatever judgment you choose to make about these people and about what they do. They are remarkable, remarkable people. You go into CIA headquarters, and you walk up the stairs, and you know, back over the shield and all that, the iconic thing you see in all the B-rolls and movies, and you walk up the stairs to the statue, the bust of George H.W., who was one of my predecessors, and you turn to the left, and you see this mural down at the end of the hall right next to the CIA museum. Didn't know they had a museum. And it's a stylized picture of Lady Liberty. And it says, we are the nation's first line of defense. We accomplish what others cannot accomplish. We go where others cannot go. We are required, we are directed, we are authorized to operate in a very narrow space that no one else is asked, no one else is allowed to operate in. But we do it to the best, I mean, and it is in the shadows, all right? I mean, this nation conducts covert action for a reason. We don't want other people to know we did it. All right, so I freely admit we are in the shadows, but we do not check our American values at the door. These men and women went to the same high schools. They share your political culture, they share your political values. They just get to apply them in a very unusual space, and that's why I wrote it.
And so we have a question from someone who says, "Do you have any advice or suggestion for a soon-to-be college graduate interested in public policy and foreign affairs?"
So let me go back to that 160,000 applicants, okay? The applicant number is unclassified. The number we accepted is classified, so I can't give it to you, but just it's a really small number, okay? And so what were the distinguishing characteristics of the cohort we accepted? All right, three characteristics I can quickly share. Number one, the average entering age was 29. Okay? Number two, the distinguishing characteristics of the cohort that we hired was one, life experience. And for about a third of them, life experience was being an American GI. And then the other distinguishing characteristic was second language. And the more exotic, the better. All right, so if you want to go do this, if you really want to contribute, raise your hand, seriously, and volunteer. Go do interesting things. And when people come to me and say, oh, I'd really like to be a case officer or an analyst. And I said, well, keep in mind, you're going to have to be patient because the average, now, average entering age is 29. Janine and I met every one of them. Everyone we hired, my wife and I met at a social we had every quarter at CIA. And we had people on true second careers. All right. I mean, if you want somebody to have a cover story that they're an investment banker, having been an investment banker for 30 years is really good. Okay. And so that balance. So we did have some fairly
but not
young
everybody's
folks.
Jack Bauer.
No, not at all. I say in the book, Janine and I went to over 50 stations and bases in 3 years as director. Never met Jack Bauer. Never even ran into Jack Ryan. Okay. Now these are very. We live in Northern Virginia. All right? And I used to get questions about, so what kind of people work at CIA? I said, well, they're just like your friends and neighbors. And by the way, if you live where we do,
they're
your friends and neighbors. we go watch our granddaughter play soccer and kind of go, okay, I know him, I know her, I know him. I mean, these people are us. Now, but they are in unique circumstances with unique authorities. And then we ask them to do some hard things. I mean, the big we, not the singular we up here, the 330 million we, asked them to do some very hard and admittedly controversial things. I mentioned specifically that CIA operates on the outer edges of executive prerogative.
So I think we have time for one more question. At George Mason University, you teach a class on intelligence and policy and value the meaning of second and third order effects that policy creates when established. Are there any policy proposal you advocate that could increase the general citizen's understanding, yeah, responsibility, and preparation to be resilient to threats, possible consequences like cyber attacks, and its second and third order effects, and climate change, lack of intelligence policy? So I don't know what that last piece is, but second-order effects of general policy.
Yeah.
And how did people get themselves oriented? You know, the saying now is, if you see something, say something.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are multiple layers in what you just asked. So let me cut to the one that I should be able to affect the most, even in retirement. We classify too much stuff, all right? There's just too much stuff that's got a secret stamp on it. And that's pathological. I mean, you know, in the medical meaning of the word, it degrades the health of the organism. Okay, number one, it spreads your circle around too much stuff, so it's really hard to protect the really secret stuff that really ought to be protected. And number two, it builds up a sense of casualness around things marked secret that leads to bad places. Mm-hmm. And then finally, if we're going to go do this and go do it on your behalf inside today's political culture, you're just going to have to know more stuff. All right? Now, there's a downside. The more stuff you know, the more stuff they know. And we're going to shave points. No phone. We're going to shave points off of operational effectiveness by doing it. But my plea to my old tribe is, but they're not going to let you do it in the first place unless you tell them more. And so we're just going to have to be more. I used the word transparent up at Aspen last summer, and Mike Leiter is a really bright guy. He used to run the National Counterterrorism Center. Mike says, Hayden's almost got it, but we don't need to be transparent. We need to be translucent. And actually, when you think of the meaning, that's really spot on. Right. You can see the broad shapes. You can see the general movement. You can't see the fine motor movement. And that should be enough if we can find that space to make you comfortable about what it is done in your behalf.
Well, our thanks to General Hayden, former director of both the National Security Agency and the Central Intelligence Agency, and the author of the new book, Playing to the Edge, American Intelligence in the Age of Terror. It's a great book. I've read it. I hope you will get it. I think they're going to be outside. I'm Ellen Tauscher, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. My pleasure. Thank you.